Good morning, folks. I would like to welcome everybody here. Ask you to please take a seat, and so we can get started. I'm Chuck Cascio. I'm Vice President for Partnership Expansion at Educational Testing Service. On behalf of the Alliance for International Education and Cultural Exchange, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Educational Testing Service, I welcome you to today's seminar. Joining me are John Hamry, President and CEO of CSIS, Carola McGifford, Vice President of CSIS, and Michael McCary, Executive Director of the Alliance. Carola and Michael were part of the planning committee for the seminar, along with Chuck Melly and Frank Gomez of ETS, and Rana Freiberg, consultant to ETS on international education issues. Thanks to all of you for your initiative in putting this seminar together. Why us? The Alliance represents the most important organizations in the United States that manage all types of educational, professional, and youth exchange programs. And CSIS convened noted leaders in diplomacy, military affairs, education, the private sector, and other fields as a smart power commission that issued a major and very influential report in 2007. Finally, ETS, a nonprofit organization, is the world's largest educational testing and research company. ETS works help shape the education and careers of people throughout the world. The Smart Power Commission focused on five crucial areas to revive American leadership around the world. Today, we will focus on one of them, public diplomacy, and particularly building long-term people-to-people relationships, especially among youth. Specifically, the Commission recommended, one, expanding successful education exchange programs, two, launching the U.S.-China and U.S.-India educational funds, a proposal for a 10-year allocation of funds to develop country specialists in China, India, and the U.S. It would be administered by the Fulbright program. Three, expanding Middle East language competencies. And four, drawing on American cultural advantages, including immigrant communities. Our decision to come together to explore trends in international education and exchanges responds to the following key factors. First, our shared view that these activities make a unique contribution to U.S. national security and to shared success with our friends and allies, and that there should be more such programs and resources to fund them. Second, the beginning of a new administration and its efforts to adopt a smart power approach to diplomacy and foreign policy. And third, the recommendations of the CSIS Smart Power Commission. And we meet today at a time of global economic troubles, of conflicts old and new, and of unresolved, long-standing bilateral and multilateral issues that engage world leaders. President Obama has said, quote, "We've got a unique opportunity to reboot America's image around the world. We need to take advantage of that. We will be at the same time unrelenting in our desire to create a relationship of mutual respect and partnership with countries and peoples of goodwill who want their citizens and ours to prosper together. And I think the world is ready for that message," end quote. Our goal today is to provide useful and perhaps provocative perspectives on emerging Obama administration policies on exchanges and international education. We are fortunate to have a group of speakers, including eight members of the Smart Power Commission, who together comprise an extraordinary collection of talent and expertise. We are most grateful to them for giving their time to share their valuable insights today. We do have a change in the 2:45 p.m. session, joining Ambassador Thomas Pickering as panelist in a discussion of the future of public diplomacy will be Goli Amari, former Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, and Ann Witkowski, Senior Associate of the CSIS Homeland Security Program and head of the Embassy of the Future Project. Moderating that panel will be Rana Freiberg, Senior Vice President of Legislative Strategies and an expert on educational and cultural exchange. Their biographies are included in your seminar agenda. We hope to stimulate an exchange of views between our presenters and you. So our agenda allows for questions and answers and for networking during lunch and during the closing reception. The seminar is being recorded. That's what it says here. It says, be careful what you say. It doesn't really say that. The seminar is being recorded, and with your help, we hope to formulate some conclusions that we'll be able to share with you interactively later. Your seminar program has brief biographies of each presenter, so we will not make lengthy introductions. Also, Frank Gomez tells me that we must finish the morning session by 11:45, and I listen to Frank, believe me. So, I wish you a very productive day. It is now my pleasure to introduce the moderator of our first session, Rick Barton of CSIS, and a member of the Smart Power Commission, Rick.
Great. Thank you, Chuck, and welcome to all of you. It's great to be able to extend the welcome on behalf of John Hamry, our president, and CSIS. This is really a great-looking crowd. We have two distinguished members of our mostly distinguished commission of 20, they're here today, John Zogby and Alan Goodman, and I know many of you know them and are looking forward to hearing their comments. We'll try to run this as a conversation. They're each going to take about 10 minutes to make presentations. John has brought a PowerPoint. Alan has come unilaterally disarmed without one. So it's a very dangerous precedent here in Washington. But we're really pleased. The Smart Power Commission really hit on a good issue at a good time, and it was really our great fortune at CSIS to have such a terrific group of people that worked on it. We also had a lot of our scholars involved with it, and many of them went around the world, various parts of the world, to see how the United States was perceived and what we needed to do in other parts of the world. And then we tried to complement it with a listening tour here in the United States as well, which was more of a dialogue with America, and we had informal meetings with about 240 people from Iowa, Minnesota, South Carolina, New Hampshire, well before the presidential race. This was back in the spring of 2007. And many of the critical themes that came out in the presidential campaign actually came out in our listening tour as well. And it was really not a great surprise to some of us that the Obama campaign actually captured that there was sort of the zeitgeist that we had picked up early on was something that he seemed to keep his campaign very well aligned with throughout. And, of course, we've seen that picked up in the first days of this administration as well. And so it's been an interesting, rather acute sensitivity on their part to not only the feeling that a lot of Americans have, but some of the feelings that have developed around the country. As Chuck mentioned, there were five major recommendations. One of them had to do with public diplomacy. And within each of the recommendations, we had signature initiatives as well that we had. And in this particular case, in the public diplomacy, it was to invest in educational exchanges. So that's part of what we're going to talk about today. We've done this. We've had prior sessions. We had a couple of university presidents and the president of World Learning here for a similar session. I'm sure some of you were here for that a few months ago. And we've really just tried to continue to bring forward a number of the ideas that were raised in our process in this continuing dialogue here in Washington, because we realize there's just an awful lot of room to grow and a lot of opportunities for improvement. So our two speakers today are going to suggest how we can continue this momentum and really build on some of the positive energy of the moment, whether it's a golden moment or not, they will probably also speak to. And we'll look forward to making this a dialogue with all of you. So I will probably, when they finish, I will probably ask a couple of questions, and then we'll just turn to you. And depending on how many people have questions, we may stack them up or just run them one at a time. So, John, you're going to go first, if you would, and it's great to have you back. And John was just a wonderful member of our commission.
Thank you, Rick.
I'm going to be very, very brief, because the only time in my life that I've kept remarks down to 10 minutes is when somebody whispered to me to keep them down to 3. So I'm going to go really quickly here. I do have a PowerPoint, and let's see. There you go. We're just going to see some names pop up on the screen, and the obvious question and answer is, what do these people have in common? They've all studied in the United States. More than 200 world leaders, current world leaders, have studied in the United States, a long list, a very impressive list. International students studying in the United States. Let's first look at what we know about international students studying here, and then we'll look at what we know about U.S. students studying abroad. First, the number of international students is up over the past year and the past decade. The State Department visa numbers show that we are finally back to pre-2001 levels of student visas. But international students in the United States still make up only 3.5% of all university students in the U.S. Compare this with 11% in France, 12% in Germany, 16% in U.K., and 21% in Australia. Who's coming? Half of all international students come from Asia, as you can see. The black part of the map is those that sent 5,000 or more in 2006. These numbers are from 2006. And the darker gray are 1,000 to 5,000. And so what we see is that 49% coming from Asia, about half, that's up alone 43% in the past year alone. Turkey is the number one non-East Asian or South Asian country, and Turkey is 8th on the list. Let's look at the visa explosion in Asia. The green on the map is a decrease, and the blue on the map is increase. There are huge decreases throughout Latin America and Russia and Europe. Why? A survey of colleges found that 87% of student recruitment efforts are directed toward Asian nations. So why does this matter? Why should we care about it? How about an economic reason for starters? International students studying in the U.S. brought in an additional $15 billion to the United States economy in 2006-2007 alone. Those are Department of Commerce figures. International students added $1 billion to the economy of just the Washington, D.C., Virginia, Maryland area alone. Why should we care? How about a public diplomacy reason? Here are the percentages of favorable opinion, according to our polls, towards the United States from a 2008 poll that we conducted in 6 Arab nations. Those are the favorability ratings. They're actually a little bit better than they were, but no question about the fact that they are low. Sadly, and I don't have it in the PowerPoint, but in 2002, the highest percentage favorable towards the United States were among 18 to 29-year-olds, and the greatest, most precipitous drop in favorability over the years, with the lead up to the war in Iraq, with the Axis of Evil speech, with Abu Ghraib, and so on, came from 18 to 30-year-olds. How do we change that? Listen to this. In our 2004-2005 survey in these same countries, the results showed that respondents who had been to the United States have relatives who have traveled to the United States, or who they themselves had interest in traveling to the United States, had on average a 25-point more favorable opinion towards the United States than any other group. And a poll we did of Americans showed that Americans who were interested in learning more about a specific nation in the Middle East, we're also much more likely to hold a favorable opinion about the countries in the region. According to Anne-Marie Slaughter, a wonderful piece in Foreign Affairs, the United States should see its immigrants as living links back to their home countries and encourage a two-way flow of people, products, and ideas. More from Anne-Marie Slaughter, the United States' advantage is rooted in demography, in geography, and culture. The United States has a relatively small population, only 20 to 30% of the size of China's or India's. Having fewer people will make it easier for the United States to develop and profit from new energy technologies alone. She continues, the network world provides a hopeful horizon. In this world, with the right policies, immigrants, students, can be a source of jobs rather than a drain on resources, able to link to their home, to their new home, with markets and suppliers in their old homes. Businesses in the United States can orchestrate global networks of producers and suppliers. Consumers can buy locally from revived local agricultural and customized small business economies, and at the same time, globally, from anywhere they can advertise online. The United States has the potential to be the most innovative and dynamic society anywhere in the world. Now, what do we know about U.S. students studying abroad? The number of students, American students studying abroad is up over the past year and the past decade, but we're still sending only 1.3% of all of our students abroad. Where are they going? The top five destinations are the UK, 15%, Italy, 13%, Spain, 11%, along with France at 11%, and China at 5%. And I have no idea what that map is referring to. So just picture those numbers in your mind, okay? Thank you.
We appreciate the credit you gave us on the map.
Oh, okay. But we obviously lifted the wrong chart, I think. Okay, thank you. I'm not good with numbers, so I'm glad. Who is going? There are 35,000 international students in the United States, compared with just 17,000 U.S. students studying abroad. This imbalance is hurting us. If we look at these numbers alone, what we see is that whites make up 58% of the students, of all students. 82% of the students studying abroad are white. And then you see the disparate numbers between African Americans and Hispanic Americans. How long are they staying? Half stay less than a semester. Nearly all stay less than 1 year. Compare that with 60% of international students studying abroad or studying in the U.S. who are here getting PhDs. In this world, the measure of power is connectedness. Our leaders want it. This was President Obama in Turkey. Simple exchanges can break down walls between us. For when people come together and speak to one another and share a common experience, then their common humanity is revealed. What do we know from our polling? The imbalance in current numbers does not reflect our policy goals. Too few international students are studying here. Too few of our students are going abroad. We know where they want to go. We know that we want them to go. We have to create a policy that will make it happen. From a survey of 18 to 30-year-olds that we took online in Latin America, we discovered 50% of those that we polled expect to live or work abroad at some time in their lives. 69% plan to travel abroad within 5 years. We have to create a policy that allows this to happen. How else is this lack of exchange hurting us? We're not preparing our first global citizens to live or work overseas, or for that matter, to work and interact with people from other countries who come here to work. And it's not consistent with what that generation is learning on the internet and through social networking. And finally, it's dangerous to our smart power goals. We need to build a greater appreciation of those who want to do business with and those who want to coexist with each other. And fixing this problem is a great place to start. I have quite a few numbers of comments to make about this, but I'll save that for the Q&A period. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Thanks very much. As Alan is settling in, let me ask a couple of quick questions of this audience. How many people are U.S. citizens? And so how many, maybe the better question is, how many people are not U.S. citizens? Okay. How many of you have studied overseas? How many of you have a second generation, say two generations of family members that have studied overseas, either your children or however? So pretty. How many of you are now working in this field? Okay, great. Thanks. Alan.
That was the quickest poll I've ever seen done. I do want to thank the Alliance and Mike McCary and his staff for suggesting that we have a seminar like this. It's an important day and an important time to have. And we're all grateful to ETS because for many students around the world, the test of English as a foreign language is the way in which they discover America, enter America, take the test, and then use the Education USA network to see where they could go. That's sponsored by the Department of State. And it was a privilege to serve on the CSIS Smart Commission. The commissioners were very distinguished. When my daughter looked at the list, she said, "Gee, I didn't know you were that distinguished, but I didn't know you were smart." So it was a little bit of a, it was awesome to say the least. And Rick did this fabulous series of focus groups and town meetings around the United States, which brought a real sense of how Americans outside the Beltway were thinking about these issues. And John's work in the polling brought a sense of how people around the world at that critical age group, 18 to 30, were thinking about America just as we were beginning to have this deliberation. And in some senses, it was an antidote to the unremitting bad news that would come out of the Pew polling data. So both of their work helped us a lot. In thinking about what I would say in the remaining 9 minutes, I had a conversation just a week ago with a former U.S. ambassador to Argentina. And we got to talking about Fulbright and what an impact Fulbright made on his ability to be an American diplomat. And he said at one point, "I'll never forget," he said, "the man that probably was my strongest supporter in Buenos Aires, a frequent visitor to the embassy, a sympathetic listener, someone we could have a real dialogue with." And he told me one day that he used to come to the embassy as a young man to throw rocks. Then he got a Fulbright, and then he changed. And he changed his mind about the United States and about our people. And in our field, we don't do enough of what John does in his field. We don't have enough polling data to show that. And we also know when Edward R. Murrow was head of USIA, he used to say that no cash register rings when somebody changes their mind. But that's the business all of us are in, and that's what smart power does. It is about changing the way people think and act toward each other through mutual understanding. We're focused today on, and Carola and Rick asked me to talk about where I thought the major changes were going to occur. And let me just address three. First, I think as you think about international education, think about the slides that John just showed about how many young people want international education to be part of their educational experience, that we are now entering a period where we're going beyond mobility. It's not just about getting more students abroad, however briefly they go. We're really changing the paradigm. I'd like to think that by the end of our working careers, international will be part of what it means to be educated, and that no one will get an undergraduate degree from particularly a U.S. institution without some sense of life, study, culture, processing facts in a country outside their own. Now, we have a long way to go, as John's graph showed, but I think people today are thinking differently about the paradigm. This morning, NYU announced that it was opening a campus in Washington, D.C. That's not the big news. The big news is that NYU is defining the paradigm of what it means to be a university. It has and will open a campus in Abu Dhabi, in Beijing, and in other places. And what NYU is saying is you get an undergraduate education by starting one place and then ending up in another. 3 semesters in Abu Dhabi, 3 in Washington Square, maybe 1 here. It's redefining what it means to be a university. The 6 universities in Doha, including Georgetown, Carnegie Mellon, Northwestern, Weill Cornell, Virginia Commonwealth, Texas A&M, they're also redefining the paradigm for their own institutions, for what it means to... It's more than a branch campus. It's not like what happened in Japan in the 70s when there were lots of branch campuses, but they had no relationship to the educational enterprise and project of the home campus, and many, of course, did not survive. So first change I think we'll see in the next decade or two is a change of that paradigm, and I know some of that will be discussed this afternoon. Secondly, I think we will see a much more prominent role for government. I had the privilege of meeting our Secretary of State last week, and I know the administration is considering a new higher education initiative. I don't know what the ingredients of that initiative are going to be, but it is both about higher education and about public diplomacy and about the role that the government can play in encouraging the thing we do, which is international education. Our government is not alone. The major destination countries, again on John's, that 57% going to Western Europe, there are also educational foreign policies in all of those countries. And whether it's the Erasmus program or the Confucian Institutes and the Hanban program of China, governments are entering our space, and they're going to make a difference. They're going to make it possible for more students to study abroad. They're going to make it possible for more institutions to be sustained. So I think that's the second thing we'll see, and particularly in the next months, I think we will see a new higher education initiative. And third, I think we're entering, the only way I can describe it is a multipolar world. The superpower in international education and in education is the United States, but it's not alone. If you think about what Singapore is doing through the National University of Singapore, if you think about what China is doing about the Hanban and Confucian Institutes, and the fact that maybe this year there are 100,000 foreign students in China from all over the world, you think about what they're doing in science, it may be that they are becoming a superpower when it comes to graduate science education, just like we are. If you take a ruler and you draw a 750-mile radius around Doha or Abu Dhabi or Dubai, you have 50 or 60 new institutions and new projects ranging from a completely new university like the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology, to Michigan State in Dubai, to NYU in Abu Dhabi, to the 6 universities in Doha from the United States, soon to be added 3 from 2 from Western Europe and 1 from Asia. So Education City becomes something different, than just Doha or just the place that Virginia Commonwealth and Cornell Wilde started with a small experiment. So we're going to live and work in a very multipolar world. All of this will benefit higher education, because why should it be that our kids are the only ones that don't speak another language, that don't have a chance to study abroad, that aren't citizen ambassadors? And living and working in a multipolar world, or redefining universities as NYU is doing, is going to make a huge difference. It also affects public diplomacy. And I'll conclude here. My first trip to Doha was in 2003, just before the war, like minutes before the war. And there were only two universities there at that time, Virginia Commonwealth and Weill Cornell. And I happened to be put in the hotel, which was the site of the Islamic summit. I think my wife and I were the only two non-practicing Islamists in the hotel. And I decided that this was a terrific opportunity to meet people that I would never have a chance to meet with. And so it was easy. Hi, my name is Goodman. I'm from Washington. And I realized that maybe in 2003, on the edge of a war, that wasn't exactly. And then I said, we administer Fulbright on behalf of the State Department. And then it was as if clouds and curtains parted. People said, oh, I had a Fulbright here, I had a Fulbright there. My nephew's going to Texas. My daughter or my niece is going to California. I hope my son will have a chance to go. And then you just name the schools. There was a lot of talk about California as a magnet, and one young man from Saudi Arabia said it was the best experience I ever had. And then this booming voice, someone grabbed me from behind, and she said, I too, like Khalid, am a proud Trojan. And I turned around, and there was a woman covered from head to toe with just the eyes. And you wonder what is going on beneath that veil when she's had a four-year education at a university in Southern California. You know it makes a difference, and it will make a difference to our public diplomacy to be able to meet in that space and talk about common values. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you, Carlos.
I think you both have uplifted us and begun the conversation just where we wanted it. I'd like to add a couple things to comments that each of you made. Sometimes I think our own self-image is that we are a somewhat cloistered country, that we are clearly the word that kept coming up when we did this dialogue with America was that we were arrogant. But I think another way to think about this is just how many tens of millions of Americans have a working relationship with some other part of the world. And so rather than thinking of ourselves as being quite so closed off, if we think in terms of 33 million or whatever the number is now, first-generation Americans, if we think of the tens of millions of Americans who send remittances overseas, the tens of millions that have passports, maybe they're not all members of Congress, but nevertheless it's a large, large number. If we think of over 10 million Americans who are supporting a child somewhere else in the world, there are obviously going to be some overlaps in these numbers. But when you start to add them up, there probably are people who give to charities that are active in other countries, plus these exchange numbers and whatnot. I think we could, my suspicion is that we could make an argument, and you might have the numbers, John, and can speak to this when we get to it, that there is a significant percentage, probably more than half of Americans, who are living some kind of global experience. Mm-hmm. Now, in Greenville, South Carolina, when we were there, I was surprised to hear that it is the highest percentage for a city. It has the highest percentage of local citizens working for a foreign-owned company of any place in the United States. They have a Japanese school there, a French school there, and a German school there. They're becoming a global auto center, basically. That's the industry that they've decided to convert to. And so there was a pretty rich appreciation of their global status, something that for years of sort of living behind a protectionist wall, they were now thinking in a much more global sense, the way that I think you described, Alan. There's something also that you said, that John, that kind of inspired me a little bit in terms of how we think about the world. I was having dinner maybe 10 years ago with, I think it was John Hume, who was the Nobel Prize winner for Northern Ireland Peace, and he had been the moderate side of the Catholic debate. And I was asking him about his family, and he said, well, my son is working in Atlanta, and my daughter is in, I forget where she was, in London. He said, when I was growing up in Derry, if I walked a block, it was a high-risk proposition, and my mother would have been shocked. For her to hear that her grandchildren are now working in sort of their axis of evil was a pretty shocking thing. So these are inevitable developments that are taking place, and really lead to a couple of the questions that I have and for you at this point. And then please prepare yourselves to flail your arms if you would. The first one really is, we're in a period of global economic pressure, and which is likely to decrease the opportunities for expensive exchanges. And so I'd like to get your thoughts on what are some of the more promising exchanges that might give us an equal boost during a time that the more expensive pieces could be challenged, let's say.
Well, I think the first thing that we need to do is take a look closer at the polling data and realize the degree to which this internationalization is demand-driven, that there's a change in mindset that is taking place before our very eyes. So for starters, 56% of our 18 to 30-year-olds have passports and have traveled abroad. That's the largest age cohort, and that number is growing. 1 in 4 and growing of this age cohort tell us that they expect to live and work in a foreign capital at some point in their lives. Let's go take a look at some polling data from a completely different source. Over the years, over the last 21, 22 years, I have polled school districts all over the country. And generally, it's a needs assessment, a curriculum evaluation, and so on. But consistently, when we ask parents and non-parents, what is it that this school district should be doing, the number one answer always is, preparing our children for the world of work in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. But what's happened just in the last decade is how they define the world of work in the 21st century. And we've seen these communities, the people in these communities, move from new technologies in my own community to whatever it takes, wherever it takes our children to go to get the best education and the best possible job. Completely different piece of evidence. We polled a group called the Young Arab Leaders in 2006. Now, there are chapters throughout the Arab world. These are under 45 years of age, men and women who've achieved some sort of success in their profession or in business. And the focal point are the Emirates. That's where the largest chapter is. So we polled 400 of these people in the Emirates. And on one hand, they told us that aside from family, the number one thing that they wanted was to succeed in their business or profession. How can you best succeed? Well, we need the tools and we need the level of education. Very importantly, where would you go to receive those tools and that education? And they said, number one, first and foremost, the United States. Last on the list, China and Japan. There's no cultural affinity there. But the very next question was, who is your hero? And the number one answer from these very same people at that point in time, this is August, September of 06, was Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah. Why? Because he stood up to the United States. So you have this huge disconnect there, but yet the understanding is that this is the platinum standard. Now, how do we put all of these together? It is demand-driven. Universities are ready for this and will gladly make room for it. In fact, any university I've spoken at is prepared to accept foreign students and wonders why there hasn't been this expansion. Our kids are going abroad anyway. And it's not just the rich kids, and it's not just the Ivy League kids. It is just part of the conversation among young people, whether they call it the gap year or the gap years. There is an understanding that between getting a backpack and couch surfing somewhere, part of my life in my 20s is to go abroad. How do we facilitate that? And if they're willing to do it on their own, with the help of mom and dad, to be sure, there ought to be a way to bridge that, institutionalize it, find networks of websites, facilitate that travel, make deals with hotels and hostels and airlines and so on, because the kids are just doing it anyway.
Just a couple of points to think back to the trend line and the gross numbers of foreign students coming here ever since we began tracking it in the 1920s. There's actually only been two periods of decline. Now, one is immediately after the Iranian Revolution, and Iranian students were the biggest foreign student group in America for a very long time, and after 9/11. The recession we're going through, and other countries are going through, is different than the Iranian Revolution or 9/11, which makes me think we're not going to see any dips because of either our rising cost or economic problems. It could happen, but I'm not expecting it at this point. What I think is going to happen is people will look at price a lot more sensitively and discover the jewel of American higher education, which is the community college. You can start there at significantly lower cost and go through an articulation agreement onto dozens of four-year institutions. Now, our Open Doors numbers says that only about 4%, I think, of international students in America today are at community colleges. I think it could conceivably be 40% in the next decade. As people discover that's the way to enter, that's the way to get your English skills set, your acculturation set, and that's the way to go to the University of California, the University of Washington, the University of Michigan, in the public system. So we need to do a better job abroad of explaining something that is untranslatable. When you address a foreign audience and say, let me tell you about articulation agreements, it's like you come from Mars. It is not something that barely is it understandable that we have community colleges, which are different than four-year colleges. There's no central authority regulating anything. But this articulation concept is a key thing that our colleges and universities need to be explaining abroad, and I think they will, and then I think the numbers will show a gravitation to that.
Great. Thanks, Alan. Let me ask one last question, and then one last point as well. When I was working at the UN in Geneva, the chairman of our executive committee at the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees was the Iranian ambassador, and he had done his graduate work in Michigan, and obviously had so there he was, a representative of a pretty tough administration, but he had a rather good view of the United States as well. Getting back to that last point you were making, I think it's a good one to build on. Some people would argue that if you really want to change American communities, that reaching into high schools is going to have more of an impact on a community than just plucking out university students or bringing university students. And we know that that's a very low number of, a much lower number of Americans that are studying overseas or exchange students that are coming here. I think the American Field Service has about which is, I think, one of the larger programs, has about 6,000 international students coming here a year now. What do you see as that? Do you agree with that concept? I mean, not that they're both good ideas, but how do we reach into that particular pool and maybe energize that more? Because that's an even lower cost version of your community college model that you were describing.
I'm not sure. I am sure that if we could get to people much earlier, because like 60% of graduating seniors in high school think they're going to have a study abroad experience, and only 1% end up doing. So somebody is planting the seeds, and the more we can plant the seeds and maybe give them the experience, the better. I don't know how we do that, given how differentiated and decentralized our system is. I do know that through Fulbright, the foreign language and English language teaching assistant program brings an awful lot of people to college campuses and smaller communities who teach not only the language but the culture. And I do expect that part of Fulbright is going to continue to grow. It also gets Americans who go abroad and teach in high schools as well as colleges to, again, have an impact on the community. And maybe it is through the language teaching that mm-hmm. that kind of impact is going to occur.
It's also technology as well. You know, just on their own, you know, we have polled high school students and college students for years in separate polls, and we've always asked a question over the last 20 years, who are your friends? And what's changed, obviously, in the last 5 or 6 years is the transformation of friendships from the person that I meet with between classes or work with or hang out with on weekends to I have this friend in Thailand, or part of my network is in Sao Paulo, and they love that. They're doing it on their own. How do we facilitate that? They want this global experience. They expect a global experience, and there are ways of doing it through social networking and connectivity, through coursework, through joint course taking with high school students abroad. That is a relatively easy thing to do that makes the lives of social studies teachers, let alone literature teachers, so much more fascinating. And I'm assuming that the kids are pretty much going to be doing that on their own anyway through the various methods that they themselves have discovered. Now, how do we facilitate that? And that then sets the table and whets the appetite for the actual physical relocation.
Okay, let's turn to your questions, and if you could please just introduce yourself and make sure that it is that whatever you say ends up in a question within 1 minute. This woman right in the middle, or the microphone is right behind you, if you'd wait, since this has been rebroadcast. Thanks.
Thank you. Sherry Mueller with the National Council for International Visitors. We've talked a lot about numbers, and I wonder where some of the best research is being done on the quality of the experience international students have here. Alan, you mentioned that there were lots of Iranians prior to the hostage crisis in 79 and 80, and I know the book by Moorhead Kennedy, where he talks about the international students in our country as a treasure trove or a recipe for concern, and he points out that some of his captors had studied at Georgetown University. So where do we...
A dangerous institution.
What do we know about the research being done on quality as well as the numbers? Thank you
Great.
Very much.
Thanks. You know, because there's so many questions, if you guys are okay with it,
sure,
I think I'd like to take 3 or 4 questions in that way. Maybe just since you're right there with the microphone, let's grab those two women at that table.
Actually, I don't have a question. It's a response to the question that was just raised.
Tell us who you are.
I'm Rajika Bhandari, Director of Research.
And remember, you have 1 minute.
At IIE. Mm-hmm. And your question's a really good one, because there's a real lack of information, of qualitative information, on international students in the U.S., but the good news is that we are planning some research in that area where we are attempting to roll out a 3-part survey that's going to look at prospective international students in their home countries, look at students in the U.S., and then look at students who've gone back to their countries to see what they really gained from the experience. So while there's hardly any information right now, there is going to be some future data, hopefully.
Thank you for that contribution. That woman right next to you, sure.
Hi, I'm Mindy Reiser. I actually worked for the Fulbright program for a number of years. This is addressed to Mr. Zogby. Not only academic institutions, but associations, I think, have a wonderful role in linkages. For example, the United Nations Association of the National Capital Area facilitated exchanges through the United Nations Model UN, brought in students from Ghana and Mexico, facilitated international video conferences. So say a word about the role of the non-governmental organizations and associations in this kind of work, because they're incredibly important players.
They are, and Sherry certainly represents one of those organizations. I was just in the Ozarks, incidentally, yesterday.
I heard about your trip to Harrison, Arkansas.
But, you know, the fact of the matter is that there are really very positive roles that these groups have already been playing, but now need to even further make the transition in this new economy, this new worldview that we have. You know, that we have had Model UNs now for 50 years, but now the opportunity to do Model UNs electronically with not just the kid from Elm Street representing Ghana, but somebody from Ghana actually representing Ghana, is mind-boggling. And those are relatively easy transitions to make with universities providing the technology, you know, to expedite what NGOs do. Absolutely.
Alan, do you want to jump in on either of those first two? Okay. Why don't we grab this woman right here, and then we'll try to, we're not going to forget you over here.
Okay. I'm Peggy Orchowski with the Hispanic Outlook magazine. I hate cluster questions because often you just answer the ones you want, so I hope you answer this one as a journalist. But I'd like you to address the tie-in with immigration. I was at an AEI conference a couple of weeks ago on high-tech workers, and they've called the foreign student visa, came up that foreign student visa has become a provisional immigration visa. And I'm wondering, in the terms of exchanges, something like 70%, I think, of graduate foreign students end up staying on. So I'm wondering, in the terms of exchanges and all that, how that's beginning to look. Also, that this brings the temporary visa, which is an unlimited visa, into now we get into the immigration numbers game. So it could be that they start getting limited. So I just would like you to make comment on that, please.
Well, just to show you how user-friendly we are, we'll answer your question immediately.
You know, going back to my Ozark experience, I learned yesterday that Sam Walton's foundation in Arkansas provides scholarships to Central American students to study here in the United States, and providing that they go back to their hometown.
Are those undergrads or grads?
Those are undergrads. Yeah, which is interesting. There are those kinds of provisions that can be made, I think, that students will snap at. But, you know, by and large, I think what we need to do is recognize that mobility is a part of our first global citizen's mindset, that they may end up in their home country, but by and large, just as there are Americans who are expecting to live and work abroad, there are Latin Americans and Asians and Middle Easterners who are expecting the same thing. And that there are companies like IBM, for example, that are just simply redefining what the globally integrated corporation are all about, that it's all about mobility. Because, you know, and I hate to keep harping on this, but because that is what young people want. They are going to just redefine the rules of engagement here. I don't think we're going to be able to impose any sorts of limitations.
There is a commission study being done by the Council on Foreign Relations on immigration and on comprehensive immigration reform, and a big part of it is looking at critical skills that this country may need, and immigration, student visa, H-1B types of issues. And not to get ahead of the Commission's findings, which will come out, I think, next month, we do face a big dilemma as a country about whether we need people to stay or go. If you have an elderly parent in a nursing home, and suddenly all the people that came here to care for them had to go home, you might have a different view of this issue. In the STEM fields, 73% of the people who teach in the STEM fields are now international students getting PhDs because Americans are not producing Americans to go into science, math, and technology. And we may need a critical skills policy the way Canada, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, Scotland are developing that. So stay tuned.
You may want to go see, there's a movie out they call Sugar, which is about a Dominican baseball player and his experience in Iowa. And it's really a very lovely little movie that captures a lot of the arguments in a not particularly idealized nor difficult way, just in a very thoughtful way. Yeah, just wait 1 second. Usually start talking, then it sort of comes on.
Thank you. Hi, Michelle Renz from GMAC. Appreciate your comments, Mr. Zogby, about demand. And in spite of the changing global mindset, accessibility is key. And I was just thinking of Mr. Goodman's remarks about the Middle East and the 2005 agreement between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, which resulted in 5,000 full-paid scholarships for many of the Saudi Arabian students who came to the U.S., doubling their numbers in this country. So I'm wondering, are there any large-scale or potential initiatives like this happening right now that would impact students in the U.S. today or in the future?
I honestly don't know the answer to that. Are you aware of any large initiatives?
I think in the next year we will see very large initiatives coming out of other Gulf countries with the objective of having people in the United States, but not exclusively.
Yes, sir. And let's cluster these, unless you've got a problem with a concept.
Dave Cardis, the director of Florida State University's Institute for Energy Systems. I do a lot of recruiting in Southeast Asia. We also have an interest in Latin America. And what I'm finding is purely anecdotal, so I'd really like Dr. Zogby to address this. There seems to be, amongst the most best qualified students that I try to recruit, a growing sense of nationalism in the targeted age group of 18 to 35. And I think if we don't find a way to embrace this nationalism that's developed, and I see it in my own students, so American students are doing it. The internet seems to be creating a sense of growing sense of identity among groups. We have to embrace that. The best qualified students aren't coming to America because our immigration policies are keeping them. If they want to come, they're going to come. And they're not coming because there's not a lack of funds. There are funds. They're not coming because they don't want to. The best and the brightest. How do we overcome that? How do we embrace the nationalism and get those people to come to the U.S.?
Okay. You want to take? Let me take a couple of minutes.
Yeah, sure.
If you don't mind. Why don't we grab this gentleman here, and then we'll go over to this table over here.
Thank you. My name is Van Wood, and I'm representing Virginia Commonwealth University, one of those universities
Great.
In Doha that you mentioned. I guess my question and comment is that at VCU we have a significant push to globalize. At the same time, 25% of our incoming students are first-time college students, first generation. And what we find is that when we approach them with an idea of how about you going abroad and studying abroad during your time, they're stunned. They're in a position where they're saying, "I just got into college.
Right.
Going abroad is like." But when we back, this is only anecdotal evidence. But when we back up into their families and talk to their parents about this issue of what is working in the 21st century really mean and how do you be successful there, and explain the importance of this, that family gets behind this and they're off and running. But I see no initiatives like this. No, we really want to do this. What drives young people to be successful? A big part of that is who raised you. What do they do, sure, and what do they inspire you to do? But I see very little of that in terms of the Smart Power Initiative or the some of the other things that have been done. I thought maybe our two speakers could address that issue.
Great, thank you. Let's take a couple more, and I think there's
someone. I'm going to have a comment on that.
Okay.
I'm Lisa Wishman with the State Department's Education and Cultural Affairs Bureau Youth Programs Division. And our target audience in youth programs are those kids who are 15 to 18 years old. I'm actually working on a new program with other colleagues that are going to be sending our American kids overseas to study critical foreign languages. So we've got about 550 American high school students that are going to be going abroad for summer, semester, and academic year programs between June of this year and December of 2010. My question to the members of the panel, please, has to do with how do we support these American citizens who are our future when they come back? You know, they're going overseas to study Farsi and Hindi and Turkish, also Arabic, Chinese, Korean, and Russian. Some of those languages are found in advanced levels in American high schools, but many are not. So what can we as Americans or what can we as the government do to support them when they come back being really turned on about their language skills and their intercultural skills?
Great, thanks. Let's see if we can do one more. I think there's a gentleman at that table as well, as long as you're in the neighborhood.
Hi, Nathan Bell from the Council of Graduate Schools. My question is for you, Alan. You mentioned the possibility of growth in international students at community colleges. My question, though, is how prepared are community colleges to serve the needs of that population?
Okay, great. Let's take those four questions. And Alan, you had a couple you wanted to hit.
I'm struck as I visit community colleges that they're very prepared, very open, thinking this is as important for their students as it is for a student at a research university to have a class, because they're going to work with people that are from China, India, Brazil, Pakistan. It's important to learn with them at the same time. So I'm finding that what you might think the barriers to be really rolling away, and they're very open. With respect to first-generation students attending college, university, and then you say, please study abroad. One of the things we're finding with the Benjamin Gilman scholarships, which we administer on behalf also of the State Department, 90% of the Gilman awardees are first-generation college students, and we probably have 3,000 more qualified Gilmans ready to go if the funding were there, again with about 90% being first-generation. So we're not finding it a hard argument to make. But I believe it is a hard argument on some campuses, but over time I think people are going to realize this is for their kids too, for the reasons that you suggest, because it's the world they're going to work in. And finally, with respect to there was a third question, youth programs, what comes next? We're also finding that
when they return to the U.S.
students, when they come back from a high school or a freshman experience, get really interested in Fulbright, really interested in the Boren National Security Education Programs, the National Security Language Initiatives. There's a lot our government is doing. And if you sort of think about it all together, if you start with Gilman and Fulbright and Boren and NSLI and all of these together, the United States government is a very, very large supporter, happily, of people who do the initial difficult language and continue on and have a stepladder all through their education to do that.
John, do you want to?
Just really briefly, on the issue of nationalism, that ultra-nationalism, in fact, that we see particularly in Russia and China, Southeast Asia as well. That is a reality, but this is an opportunity to bridge that. Just as I learned, you know, with the example of the Young Arab Leaders poll that I took, this is always going to be the platinum standard for getting the kinds of educational skills, for that matter, internship opportunities was something that also came up. That is the selling point more than anything else, and that offers a choice that they ordinarily, you know, wouldn't have. A gentleman from Virginia Commonwealth what a huge difference between, I'm thinking of Charlotte Simmons by Tom Wolfe, what a huge difference there is from that incoming freshman in early September or late August to the student who's into the second semester of freshman year and has acclimated. Their friends on campus are talking about global sports and global fashion and global music. They are so facile in new technologies and connectivity. And as well, as you underscored, I found out in my polls, their parents want them to go to wherever it is that makes sense. I think rather than hitting them, you know, in the at recruitment time, I think the time to recruit is after the freshman year, and it, with an indication that this is the world of work of the future. This is your world of the future, and I think you find a completely changed person. What do you do with returning students and their skills? You know, there are plenty of businesses that...
Those are high school kids, though. They're coming back to their high schools, if I can interject. Mm-hmm. They're not ready for the Borens and the NCEPs and the flagship programs.
No, understood. But there possibly are internship programs. There possibly are networking programs, you know, where they can share those experiences with others. And there are business groups out there that want to know that there's a farm team that's out there.
I have a possible
solution to that. Sure. Wait 1 second. Maybe we can get you a microphone. And then I think we'll have time for maybe two more questions. Does that sound about right, Carol?
Sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So make your comment, if you would.
This is Pat Cummins from VCU also. I'm from the foreign language area, and mm-hmm. we host on our campus the Virginia Governor's Language Academies each summer. Mm-hmm. And we do have a couple of Start Talk grants, among other things, but we've got six languages where we bring high school students in.
Oh.
Now, if perhaps we looked at funding alternatives in the future for summer study, perhaps with some internet connections for the students who are in those programs. But right now, it's been a tremendous burden in the states where the economic crisis has been so tough. But in Virginia, we have felt it was really important to maintain those things for high school students. And of course, then you need to follow up at the university level as well, looking at the articulation within the discipline. And that is a major issue. And I don't know. That was my solution to that. I will have a question. I don't know if I could.
Yeah, well, let me just add to yours, and then maybe you can take the next question. I think that we, in a lot of these conversations, we have an issue of critical mass or of tipping points or really making a difference. So 500 is wonderful. 5,000 is terrific. 50,000 can't be bad. But are we actually getting sort of the transformative effect on our society and in the educational system that I think we're really, that's probably the higher level of ambition that this conversation today is looking for. And I think to do that, we're probably going to have signature initiatives such as every high school in America should have a sister high school in China. Let's call that the critical relationship of the 21st century. That may be arbitrary, may or may not be the case, but it's not a bad guess. And those are two societies that really, really don't know each other. And we're not inclined to because our diplomatic approach is going to be, well, if they open two more consulates, then we've got to open two more consulates, and we're not sure we want another Chinese consulate in America. And that's the level of that has been the traditional level of our discussion. So the government-to-government model sometimes prevents us from making the breakthroughs at levels where the people-to-people or the educational institution-to-educational institution. But there are tens of thousands of high schools in China, and if a kid from Fargo goes to some exotic part of China, Fargo is going to know a lot more about China than it did yesterday. I mean, that's just inevitable. Mm-hmm. And I, at least when we had an AFS student and when my daughter was in Tunisia and my dad worked for IIE and then worked for USIA, I mean, this was all part of this was we just this was our lifeblood, and so we sort of had it. So we got to get to the lifeblood level of these things, and that doesn't mean mainstreaming, which would be the State Department's response to this. It really means our society taking it on, and it's not all going to come from Washington, sadly. Anyway, these are all initiatives, and all these state initiatives matter for sure, but. We've got to do more. We'll come back to you, and then these two women here. I'm sorry to have taken some of your time.
My question refers more to some of the things happening within the foreign language discipline. If we were studying biology, we would assume that people needed to be in a biology lab in order to acquire a degree in biology. Yet in foreign languages, on many campuses, it is possible to get a degree, including my own campus, without having studied abroad. There is no funding for it, and the students can't find ways of going. As Van mentioned, we have 25% first-generation college students who it's a question of getting over. It's hard to get over there. It's not impossible, but it's very hard. If I were looking at initiatives in terms of that discipline, instead of just focusing on STEM, I think we should also add foreign languages. Back in the late 1980s, early 90s, we did put the two together. I think we need to maybe consider that again. And in terms of critical languages, perhaps looking at the Mediterranean so that your student who majors in French or Spanish or Italian somehow adds on Arabic afterward. Mm-hmm. But your student mm-hmm. who's most likely to achieve a high level in Arabic or Chinese today is probably someone who started out taking one of the more traditional languages. And when you look at the Mediterranean, just mm-hmm. dealing with the critical, what's the most critical languages sometimes could be a mistake.
Great, thanks. Why don't you just pass it to these your neighbors there?
My name is Lenitra Berger. I'm from NAFIO here in Washington, D.C. We're an association of historically black colleges and universities. I attend the Open Doors briefing every November here in D.C., so I'm very familiar with the numbers of minority students who are not going abroad. And so if we're going to talk about public diplomacy, the face of America abroad is not representative of the diversity of America at home. And so I was just wondering if the Smart Power Initiative has discussed how to address this problem. I know the Gilman program does go some ways towards making sure that more minority students have the mm-hmm. opportunity to go abroad. But clearly, if the data is the same every year, how can we make this change?
Oh, great, thanks. And the woman right next to you, last question, please. Make it as tight as you can.
I'm Lori Merrow, and I'm with James Madison University in the Office of International Programs, and really appreciated your question, Lisa. And I find I do a lot of external work with external funding, and so I've done a lot of research into what languages are being offered, as we call them these days, unfortunately, strategic languages, at different universities, at what levels, and even to find even something that people think is so urgent these days as Arabic language through 4 years of university study is very difficult, even at the university level, not to mention at the high school. So I think that's just something that, you can go to the Title VI, I think it's called, universities, and find these different languages taught, but it's very difficult to find something at the universities that most of our students are going to. So it is an important, as you mentioned.
Very, 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 very briefly.
Yes, okay. My question is, and this is a very brief question, is language is so important, and not only foreign languages, but our English language. Is there any way, I've been in this long enough, so I've seen these languages called LCT, less commonly taught languages, mm-hmm. and now we call them strategic languages or critical languages. It's so insulting to people from other countries to have their language called a critical language or a strategic language in this country, if you think about how that sounds to them. And that's what we're trying to do, is win hearts and minds and make friends with people. And can we be is there any way to change that wording back to LCT or something else that's a kinder, gentler?
Sure. The answer is yes. That last question.
I knew that.
And your awareness question just helped with that. And would you like to have last words?
Yeah, I'm going to poll on that. I brought, I don't know, there's 25 or 30 of my books out there that define first global citizens. What I'd like to do is donate them to CSIS and to this group. I can't think of anything more important for me than to be able to share my ideas with the people in this room. So please, you're welcome to grab a copy of the book, and I hope you find it useful and inspiring.
Great, thanks.
And the neat thing about your Fulbright and Gilman programs is they do look a lot more like America, and they are representing the diversity of our country, and it shows what government initiatives can do to change the face and depth of those who study abroad. At the commission, I had two radical suggestions. I said if I were a college president, I'd require two things. One, everybody showed up on campus with their parents' checkbook and a passport. And within 4 years, they'd have to use the passport. And the second thing I said is I would require every student before they got my degree to be proficient in another language. I think that explains why I'm not a college president. But language and getting abroad is just central to our educational project for this century and the global citizens we all hope to encourage.
Please join me in thanking John and Alan.
Thank you. What a pleasure to do this with you.
Nice to do this.
Thank you, guys. Such a pleasure.
You've got a moderator.
Thank you.
We're going to move very quickly to the next session with Senator Hagel, but we have a very short time to grab some lunch and sit back down. We're going to be adding chairs. And if for some reason we start the talk before you've gotten food, don't worry. It'll stick around, and there'll be chance after his remarks. He's got to catch a plane, so we are going to move pretty quickly. So thank you again, Alan, Rick, and John, for a very rich discussion. And there are just a few books out there, so don't all stampede for them. But it's a really terrific, generous offer.